Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from the Bristol Radio Co-op studio in the centre of Bristol. Hello to you all and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world, including South America, I'm told, accessing the show on the internet. Today in the studio we have Colin Powers to talk about Lawful Rebellion and explain what Free Man on the Land means. Tony Gosling's serialisation of John Pilger's documentary on Barack Obama continues with part 2 of 3 and commemorates the outbreak of World War II on the 3rd of September 1939, 70 years ago this month. We'll be broadcasting Neville Chamberlain's historic speech from Downing Street, and Anthony Page interviews Sir Richard Haygate on the Book of English Magic. Malcolm Greaves also reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. And last but not least, Jeff Sparks is with us to tell us what's going on in Bristol this week. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show, and our first guest is Colin Powers. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. You're a local Bristol resident. You're from Fishponds, is it?
Resident's a bit of a weird word, but yes, I stay here occasionally.
Right. Well, we say residents because you've come up with a very sort of fancy-looking legal document that I've got in front of me. In sort of roughly 100 points, notice of understanding and intent and claim of right. And this is something that you've created yourself.
Yeah, it's part of the World Freeman Society. It's a sort of recognised document within the Society of Freemen sort of thing. Obviously it's not recognised 100% by the government, although I have got a letter back from Gordon Brown saying, yeah, okay, I acknowledge that. So I take that to be as a acceptance of it being lawfully factual and correct.
Okay. So what is the purpose of this document?
Well, you know, a little while ago I sort of started, you know, well, I've been looking into how the government works and all this business, and I found out as a corporation, you know, quite recently, sort of trades for profit, and so I thought, well, that's not quite right, so I started to look into it more and more, and it turns out, you know, that if you're not 100% happy working for the corporation of the UK, that you don't actually have to work for them, you can actually give them a sack.
So as an employee of Britain PLC or United Kingdom PLC,
it used to be a PLC, it's a limited company now, yeah.
A limited company now, right?
Yeah, okay. It just changed over.
Okay, what, is there any great significance in that?
Probably there's something to do with the fact we're going into bankruptcy again, you know.
Right, okay. So, are you what used to be known as an outlaw?
Well, no, actually, the thing about being a free man is that you're not actually allowed to be outlawed, because, in a way, if you think about it, I've as much right to just exist on the land as anyone else, and, you know, to outlaw would mean to actually cast out of your own sort of land, as it were.
Okay. So what specifically does this sort of document do that, you know, can't be done already, that isn't addressed already by, you know, Acts of Parliament already?
Well, I suppose, you know, there's more and more Acts being passed every day and things like that. And an Act is actually, in an interesting way, what it is. It's a kind of act. It's people acting in a kind of play. You could look at it like that. It's a fictional world of legal business, you know, and there they are sort of hoping that we're going to sort of fit the debt and everything like that and be the debtors to that sort of system that they're sort of perpetuating. And it's really, I suppose, just a way of just saying, well, you know, I understand what this is, my understanding. I can see what's going on. I can see how it's all sort of works with the monetary system and a lot of things like that. And,
so whereas at the moment a citizen's acceptance of the existence of the state is sort of presumed, this is a legal document that sort of says, well, that sort of makes clear that it isn't presumed and you understand. It's a legal document that sort of exists outside of...
Well, it's not really legal. I'd say it's more of a lawful document.
A lawful document.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between legal is inside the legal world, inside that world of statute. That's law form of statute.
Okay, so this exists outside of that.
Yeah, law is actually a wider form of regulations and things like that, and ideas and concepts, and has many different sort of forms. For example, we have commercial law, which governs the sort of transaction of money across continents. We have a common law, which is the common law, which is an agreement actually between the people, based around really moral sensibilities in a way.
I mean, most Acts of Parliament aren't about money. So are you saying that they are? Is this why you've created this document?
Well, actually, it's interestingly enough, that's how the government funds itself. Yeah, it actually produces bills, which are money orders, then sort of agrees that with the international bankers, who then pay the money up front for those bills, and then that's what keeps the government running in the finances, and then the courts come and collect the money for the bankers, and that's kind of how it works, yeah.
So what sort of circumstance would come about where, you know, you would take this sort of document, this notice of understanding and intent of claim of right, and what sort of circumstance would you be in where you'd have to, where this would, you know, you'd be using this, you'd be picking this up and saying, well, I've got this, and this entitles me to what?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is the same time, it's early days yet. You know, obviously, we're still negotiating with the corporation and things like that. But technically speaking, if you put in your claim of right and everything like that, then it is really your stand and how you perceive your relationship with the government. And in a way, it's the relationship between the government which actually allows them to act, to have power over you, should we say, yeah? So, for example, it's actually through consent that we actually then have a joinder to something called a person. A person is actually a corporation, which is our kind of little corporation of ourselves, which allows us to operate in the mm-hmm. in the bankrupt government sort of system.
Right. So, I mean, this is a document of sort of natural law, if you like, that you know. So you get a feeling that you've actively given consent, but I mean, are you going to be taken seriously by the addressees, for example, on it? We've got, for the express and duly noted detention of Her Majesty the Queen, Alistair Darling MP, the Lord Mayor of Bristol. I mean, do you expect these people to sort of take this sort of seriously? What are you expecting them to say in response to this?
Well, actually, yeah, big up to the Lord Mayor there. By the way, I do know that he actually got it, because I got that information back. And I know his legal departments have got it at the moment. I don't think they've done anything with it. But I got a letter back from Gordon Brown, two actually, because there's a process here. We serve this, and then after we've served a notice of understanding intent of claim of right, we serve a notice of default and an opportunity to cure, which is a chance to sort of rebut if you want. And if they still don't get a rebuttal, then you get a notice of default, and that means that then becomes law at contract level. So basically anything that comes then against your way, then you actually have a contractual basis of which to argue your point.
Okay, right. So you wanted to sort of highlight a number of points in here, particularly just before, you know, we sort of started the interview before the show. You said particular points are number 27, claim of right, number 70, lawful rebellion against government. I mean, that sounds pretty daring. What's number 70, lawful rebellion against the government?
Well, I mean, peacefully, we have a right, I believe, to rebel, as it were. No, it's quite rebelling. It's just sort of saying, you know, claiming your rights to be there. And there is a law, actually, as part of the Criminal Damage Act, which has been used numerous times, called lawful excuse. Mm-hmm. And lawful excuse allows us to actually act morally in the right way, as opposed to what the statute legislators sort of say the way you should act.
Okay.
And so basically what I'm saying in the document is I want to act morally, I want to act justly, I want to act in my own kind of my own sense of my own community. But I feel that also some of the acts are a bit sort of omnipresent and a bit sort of self-demeaning sort of thing. And yeah, I think I'm mature enough to take care of my own affairs.
A good example of what you're saying, for example, is when some people enter the premises of UDE, and damage some of the equipment that's being used to manufacture aeroplane parts, which would be used for jets that would then be sold to Israel. And they claim that the greater moral rights that they had to destroy the equipment sort of overcame the law to stop damaging the equipment, because they're saving people's lives. So this sort of like backs that up, if you like that.
It does. It probably goes one step further in the sense that also in the document itself, so it recognises the courts itself as being the corporations that they are. So that puts you in another sort of different spin, because obviously is challenging subject matter jurisdiction even before you go in.
Okay, I could go on further, but unfortunately I'll have to stop you there, and I feel that you know, this may be a point that we should come back to, and we should discuss this further. Just to sort of cover ourselves, Colin, I mean, what sort of legal qualifications do you have, and in what authority do you speak on these matters?
Well, I'm not legally qualified. I don't offer any legal advice. My perspective is more of a lawful perspective and a moral perspective.
Just to plug a website if you're interested in sort of what's been spoken of, www.tpuc.org, which I'm told it stands for the People's United Collective. But a very interesting document, and I'm sure if you look that up on the internet, you'll find a lot more about it. And well, good luck with your sort of your campaign. And
thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, Colin's also going to sing us a song now. I mean, are you sort of qualified to be able to play this song anyway?
I don't know, but I'm just going to give this one out to all those people looking forward to the New World Order.
Okay.
Here we go. I can't.
it's time for that break to find, and my heart is slipping away. I'm gonna be a new world order junkie, filled to the brim with the facts you keep pumping me, and now it's true. I can't do without you. Well, I give you all my cash for electricity, but whatever you do, don't mention free energy, now it's true. I can't live without you. Cause you can trick me, you microchip me, catch me singing and dancing on the CCTV, and it's true. I can't live without you. Well, I can't run, no, I can't hide. Now I've got that microchip is buried inside, with a microwave sent to my brain. My morality is slipping. Spies and tap phone lines, and state sponsored terrorists to keep you in line. And if you quest why and question why, then we'll come and take you away. Cause I'm looking forward to this new world order. I'll be sucking from its nipple like a lamb from the slaughter, and it's true. I can live without you. Yes, it's true.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Australian-born journalist John Pilger is probably best known for his epic ITV documentaries telling the hidden stories in conflict zones from Vietnam to the West Bank and Gaza in Israeli-occupied Palestine. His last film, The War on Democracy, has won several awards and is about the United States' interventions in Latin America. But with the demise of ITV, so it is possible that an era of films has come to an end. As the man himself might say, though, never fear. Mr. Pilger's analysis of the first few months of the presidency of Barack Obama is just as fearless as his previous films. And we're bringing you his recent speech in Australia over the next, 2 weeks. This is part two of three. Last week we had part one. This week he looks at Obama's first 6 months and what Obama's administration is doing to blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional war.
Within 3 days of his inauguration, Obama was ordering the death of people in faraway countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan. And yet, the peace movement, it seems, is prepared to look the other way and believe that the cool Obama will restore, as Krugman wrote, the nation of moral ideals. Not long ago, I visited the American Museum of History in the celebrated Smithsonian Institute in Washington. One of the most popular exhibitions was called The Price of Freedom, Americans at War. It was holiday time, and lines of happy people, including many children, shuffled through a Santa's grotto of war and conquest, where messages about their nation's great mission were lit up. These included tributes to the quote, and I quote, exceptional Americans who saved a million lives, unquote, in Vietnam, where they were, quote, determined to stop communist expansion, unquote. In Iraq, other brave Americans, quote, employed airstrikes of unprecedented precision, unquote. What was shocking was not so much the revisionism of two of the epic crimes of modern times, but the sheer scale of omission. Like all US presidents, Bush and Obama have very much in common. The wars of both presidents, and the wars of Clinton and Reagan, Carter and Ford, Nixon and Kennedy, are justified by the enduring myth of exceptional America, a myth the late Harold Pinter described as, and I quote, a brilliant, witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. The clever young man who recently made it to the White House is a very fine hypnotist, partly because it is indeed extraordinary to see an African-American at the pinnacle of power in the land of slavery. However, this is the 21st century, and race, together with gender and even class, can be very seductive tools of propaganda. For what is so often overlooked and what matters, I believe, above all, is the class one serves. George Bush's inner circle, from the State Department to the Supreme Court, was perhaps the most multiracial in presidential history. It was PC par excellence. Think Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. It was also the most reactionary. Obama's very presence in the White House appears to reaffirm the moral nation. He's a marketing dream. But like Calvin Klein or Benetton, he is a brand that promises something special, something exciting, almost risque, as if he might be radical, as if he might enact change. He makes people feel good. He's a postmodern man with no political baggage, and all that's fake. In his book, Dreams from My Father, Obama refers to the job he took after he graduated from Columbia in 1983. He describes his employer as, and I quote, a consulting house to multinational corporations, unquote. For some reason, he doesn't say who his employer was or what he did there. The employer was Business International Corporation, which has a long history of providing cover for the CIA with covert action and infiltrating unions and the left. I know this because it was especially active in my own country, Australia. Obama doesn't say what he did at Business International, and there may be absolutely nothing sinister, but it seems worthy of inquiry and debate as a clue to perhaps who the man is. During his brief period in the Senate, Obama voted to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for the Patriot Act. He refused to support a bill for single-payer health care. He supported the death penalty. As a presidential candidate, he received more corporate backing than John McCain. He promised to close Guantanamo as a priority, but instead he's excused torture, reinstated military commissions, kept the Bush gulag intact, and opposed habeas corpus. Daniel Ellsberg, the great whistleblower, was right, I believe, when he said that under Bush a military coup had taken place in the United States, giving the Pentagon unprecedented powers. These powers have been reinforced by the presence of Robert Gates, a Bush family crony, and George W. Bush's powerful Secretary of Defense, and by all the Bush Pentagon officials and generals who have kept their jobs under Obama. In the middle of a recession, with millions of Americans losing their jobs and homes, Obama has increased the military budget. In Colombia, he is planning to spend $46 million on a new military base that will support a regime backed by death squads and further the tragic history of Washington's intervention in that region. In a pseudo-event in Prague, Obama promised a world without nuclear weapons to a global audience mostly unaware that America is building new tactical nuclear weapons designed to blur the distinction between nuclear and conventional war. Like George Bush, he used the absurdity of Europe threatened by Iran to justify building a missile system aimed at Russia and China. In another pseudo-event at the Annapolis Naval Academy, decked with flags and uniforms, Obama lied that America had gone to Iraq to bring freedom to that country. He announced that the troops were coming home. This was another deception. The head of the Army, General George Casey, says with some authority that America will be in Iraq for up to a decade. Other generals say 15 years. Chris Hedges, the very fine author of Empire of Illusion, puts it very well. President Obama, he wrote, does one thing and Brand Obama gets you to believe another. This is the essence of successful advertising. You buy or do what the advertiser wants because of how they make you feel. Unquote. And so you are kept in a perpetual state of childishness. He calls this junk politics. But I think the real tragedy is that Obama, the brand, appears to have crippled or absorbed much of the anti-war movement, the peace movement. Out of 256 Democrats in Congress, 30, just 30, are willing to stand up against Obama's and Nancy Pelosi's war party. On June the 16th, they voted for $106 billion for more war. The out-of-Iraq caucus is out of action. Its members can't even come up with a form of words of why they are silent. On March the 21st, a demonstration at the Pentagon by the once mighty United for Peace and Justice drew only a few thousand. The outgoing president of UPJ, Leslie Kagan, says her people aren't turning up because, and I quote, it's enough for many of them that Obama has a plan to end the war and that things are moving in the right direction, unquote. And where is the mighty Move On these days? Where is its campaign against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? And what exactly was said when Move On's executive director, Jason Rubin, met Barack Obama at the White House in February? Yes, a lot of good people mobilized for Obama. But what did they demand of him? Working to elect a Democratic presidential candidate may seem like activism, but it isn't. Activism doesn't give up. Activism doesn't fall silent. Activism doesn't rely on the opiate of hope. Woody Allen once said, I felt a lot better when I gave up hope.
That was Australian journalist, author and New Statesman magazine columnist John Pilger. And we'll be hearing more of John Pilger's assessment of the new US president here on Dialect next week. This month commemorates the outbreak of World War II on the 3rd of September 1939. Neville Chamberlain broadcast to the nation declaring that a state of war existed between Britain and Germany. Here is the broadcast itself in its entirety made 70 years ago this month, and here it is.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany. You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honourable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland, whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we and France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage. At such a moment as this, the assurances of support which we have received from the Empire are a source of profound encouragement to us. When I have finished speaking, certain detailed announcements will be made on behalf of the government. Give these your close attention. The government have made plans under which it will be possible to carry on the work of the nation in the days of stress and strain that may be ahead. But these plans need your help. You may be taking your part in the fighting services or as a volunteer in one of the branches of civil defense. If so, you will report for duty in accordance with the instructions you receive. You may be engaged in work essential to the prosecution of war or the maintenance of the life of the people, in factories, in transport, in public utility concerns, or in the supply of other necessaries of life. If so, it is of vital importance that you should carry on with your jobs. Now may God bless you all, and may He defend the right. For it is evil things that we shall be fighting against: brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression, and persecution. And against them I am certain that the right will prevail.
That was Neville Chamberlain announcing the outbreak of war between Britain and Germany on the 3rd of September 1939. And now, just to suit the mood perfectly and go the full Monty, we've got the Dam Busters March by Eric Coates for you. The Dam Busters March, let's tell you a little bit about that. Well, the Dam Busters were immortalised in World War II folklore as a result of the attacks on the dams of the Ruhr as part of the Allies' bombing campaign against Germany. During the war, the Dam Busters was an elite Lancaster bombing unit, and the raid was led by Commander Guy Gibson, VC. The raid is remembered not only for the bravery of the men involved, but for the unique contribution made by Dr. Barnes Wallace, who developed the unique bouncing bomb that was used on the raid. Under the codename Chasty, 19 Lancaster bombers took off from Scampton in Lincolnshire on the night of May the 16th, 1943. They had three primary targets, the Mone, Ida and Scorpe dams, and two secondary ones, the Lister and Enep dams. Gibson led the first attack. At 0056 hours, the Mone dam was breached, and by 0154 hours, the Ida dam. The Scorpe dam was hit by the reserve bomber force, but unfortunately it held out. As a result of the attack, 8 Lancaster planes were lost and 56 men killed. On the ground, 1,200 people died, including 600 forced labourers from Eastern Europe. Had the Scorpe dam been breached, the damage and destructive impact on German industry would have been much greater. Eric Coates, the most famous composer of light music of the 20th century, wrote the Dam Busters March for the film of that name, made in 1954, and here it is. That was the Dambusters March, composed by Eric Coates for the film The Dambusters from 1954. The next feature comes from Trowbridge Village Pump Festival. It's an interview with folk singer Derek Moore about the Biddeford Witches. Some background noise here from the open mic event at a festival, so slight apologies for that. And it's followed by an interview with Sir Richard Hayate about his book, The Book of English Magic.
My name's Derek Moore, and I've come to the festival. This is about the 12th time I've been.
Tell us about the song that you're going to sing shortly.
Okay. It's a song that I wrote about the Biddeford Witches, because they've been forgotten sometimes in the folklore of the Southwest. And it was a tragedy that three women could be accused of something, A, they didn't do, and B, even if they did believe in those facts, why should they be treated the way they were? They were the last women to be hung in this country for witchcraft.
And what period are we talking about?
Okay, it was the 17th century, 1658. It was because they didn't understand it. There were women who had a view on the world which perhaps wasn't shared by the orthodoxy, the church and the magistrates and the royalty and the aristocracy. And they just felt scared of anything that they didn't understand. And what's worse is it's probably these three women weren't witchcrafts. They were just poor beggars. And they were just different from the rest of the community.
Why were they the last to be hung then?
There was another woman in Dorset that was sentenced to death after these three. But it seems that she was given a reprieve. For some reason in Devon there was no reprieve. And the three women were taken down to Exeter and all hung on the same day. Witchcraft is something which has been defined by men at some stage. Anything they don't understand in terms of a different religion or just a different way of living their life. In the past, it was something that to put down and to make an example of.
But they all seem to pick on the poor people.
These three women in Biddeford were the poorest of the poor. They had nothing. They were beggars. And they were wandering around North Devon. And because they were strangers, probably, maybe they were gypsies. Maybe they were gypsies, we don't know. But what we do know is that they were just not part of Biddeford. And they were picked on by some of the local folk who were superstitious about some of the deaths that had happened at that time. Any illness that they couldn't explain, they put down to some kind of power and looked to find somebody to blame. And this is to remember the Biddeford Witches. I must remember temperance. I'm the worst of all the fellows. For I gave hearsay evidence to send three girls to the gallows. The Mamie's church hangs from my shop, though they call me Old Tom. Once a soldier from the Civil War, back to Biddeford I've come. In faith, in fear, in poverty, through factions in the land. In conscience we still persecute those we don't understand. I must remember temperance. I'm the worst of all the fellows. For I gave hearsay evidence to send three girls to the gallows. Now Goody Grace was always ill, no pain could she endure. The doctor said 'twas witches' ways, with aught he could not cure. And Elizabeth was pricked all night as she lay in a bed. And John, he said 'twas the beggar's curse when he found his old wife dead.
I'm Richard Haygate.
And can you tell us about your book on magic, please?
Yes, it's been 2 years in the writing. It's been a huge amount of effort, but it's what it really does is it explores why England has become the epicentre of the astonishing revival of magic in the world. It's probably been the fantasy books, the Harry Potters, etc., which have driven the interest. But the fact is, there's probably over a quarter of a million people actually practicing some sort of magic in England, probably well over a million, maybe even 2 million in America, and a lot more scattered around the world. So people are taking it up, and it's really kind of coming out into the open. It has lots of established orders and things. It's really about time everyone understood it. So what the book is about, it describes a history. It describes the history of why magic came to England, the individual magicians who brought it here, who developed it. It also describes, most interestingly, what a modern magician is. So it includes interviews with 30 or 40 of the top magicians in England, kind of hard to get to because you don't find the name in the yellow pages under magician. There's several around Bristol, incidentally.
Talking about serious magicians here,
I'm not talking about stage magicians. I'm talking about people who practice magic, and magical practices are something which take a long time to learn. Most of these people may have spent even, 20 years plus learning to practice magic, as you would learn to practice, psychiatry or something. It's something which you can learn, but it does take time, and there are dangers in doing so. So there's obviously you need to learn to be careful as you go along. So these are people who have studied and practiced magic for a long time. So it describes who they are, what they do, what experiences they have, why they do it, and I think that's totally unique. And then finally it says, well, if you want to get started yourself in a simple way, here's how to get started. Here is a group to talk to, here is an internet site to go to, here's a book to read. So it's a little bit like a kind of dangerous book for boys, only it's a dangerous book for magicians.
Now, you start off in Treadwell's bookshop in London.
It's a lovely bookshop. It looks almost like sort of 200 years ago, and you go into it and it sells occult books. It's, serious magical books. It also sells one or two other simple things. And it's run by a lovely lady called Christina Oakley Hamilton, who, apart from the fact she speaks five languages and has a PhD in religious history, she's also a very, very powerful practicing Wiccan, which is modern witchcraft. So she is both a bookseller and a practitioner. So as such, like many other magical bookshops, once you go in, it's like you're passing through a little gateway. You hover in front of the shelf. You say, oh, do I dare pick that book out? Where will it take me? And Christina will say, why, just don't pick that book. Why don't you pick that book? And then just sit down and think about it. So an occult bookshop is like the first place in which you might just open your mind
get started,
yes. It's lovely. Go there, go to Treadwell's.
Can you tell us the difference, then, between a white witch and an ordinary witch?
Magic is simply a series of practices for getting in touch with whatever is out there. So you start off to say, do you believe there's anything out there? So you could be religious and go to church, or you could be a magician. In my mind, it's like, if you want to do it through the church, it's like kind of shopping at Marks and Spencer. But if you want to do it through magic, then it's like buying off the internet, so you actually practice it yourself. You learn the techniques for getting in touch with the spirit world yourself. That's really what magic is about. And witchcraft is simply one set of practices. So there are different ones. So typically in witchcraft you would find two sorts. Typically you'd find white witches, or sometimes called hedge witches, who usually take a kind of an old sort of village wise woman craft, which has been going, until about 1930, when the National Health started, if you were poor, you went to your local wise woman because you couldn't afford a doctor. So there's a lot of history of spells and herbal medicine, etc., locally, and that has survived, and a lot of young people are doing it, and they typically would call them, you would call them white witches. Then you have modern witchcraft, which is Wicca, okay? And Wicca, though, is quite different. Wicca, what it does, it was started, in fact, by a district commissioner who just came back from Southeast Asia, where magic is everywhere. You can go into a magician shop and you see a sort of list of spirits or spells on the wall. I want to have two male children or have more power or increase the amount of money I get in my job. And you buy it. And if it doesn't work in a month's time, you get your money back. So he brought all those sort of techniques, mixed them, and he formed this into modern Wicca, which is based on covens of 13 people. And it when people in the cavern want to go and start off another, they do. And that is growing incredibly. In America, it's the fastest growing religion there is. So Wicca is something practiced in groups of 13, using a lot of kind of old techniques that come from all the way around the world. Witchcraft is usually practiced singly by people who are more into that sort of, you know, natural spellcraft. Now you're going to say, what is a black witch? And the answer is to do with spiritualism. People can use it for bad. So in other words, if it's religion, you can have you know, gurus who steal your money. And you can find the same thing with magic. You can find people who are doing it the same thing, to gain power, steal people's money, gain all sorts of other sort of favours from them. So yeah, it's power. Magic is powerful stuff, and you can use it for good or bad.
Witchfinder General, the film. Why did people suddenly have a purge on witches? What brought that about?
This country, it was very mild compared to places like France and Germany. In France and Germany, tens of thousands of witches were burned at that time. It was horrific. Witchfinder was simply a bit of a chance on a con man in East Anglia who decided he wanted to have a bit of power, so he set himself up on his own, basically, as someone who went round and said, here's a witch. And eventually, people in East Anglia got fed up with him and he kind of went away. So it was a rather isolated thing in England. And there was a lot of witch trials, of course, around that time. And why did they come about? Well, I suppose it's quite interesting. If you go before that, actually, the Catholicism, which is in England, and witchcraft and natural magic kind of coexisted in many areas, you know. And then something to do with maybe there's a battle between, you know, one religion and the other. And, you know, now we have to prove how good we are. So what we're going to do is we're going to cast out evil. It's probably the worst thing underlying religion, this notion of sin and evil and the devil. A total invention, incidentally, of religion. So people wanted to prove how powerful and smart they are, powerful player. And of course, as in many cases, what they do is they pick on the weak. And the witches who are burnt were poor, probably old, you know, ugly people living in penury, probably casting a spell or two. I mean, in the book, you can see, you know, one of the sort of spells they cast. You can make a little powder of dried weasel's blood, you know, and you make it into powder. And if you put it in front of a horse, the horse will stop just like that; it won't move. Okay? Little thing. So you can imagine this lady sitting in her cottage, you see, and this rather rich bloke goes past. You see, gets up, throw it. Horse stops, right? You see, oh, sir, I can make your horse move again, but you've got to cross my palmer's hill. So it was those sort of people who were easy targets, quite frankly.
That was Anthony Page talking to Sir Richard Haygate about his book just published. The title is The Book of English Magic, written by Philip Carl Gomme and Richard Haygate. It's published by John Murray. Recommended retail price, hardback copy, mind, is £25.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time now for another beautiful instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. Eagle-eared listeners will know what it's about, but if not, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Thame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to, so he wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer Pub in Bristol.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The blank of no one to dinner for the fifth night running was filled by Tom Marshall and his wife, beastly pleasant folks, and beautiful to look at. A lovable, charming old gentleman, Sir St. Hilardley Wilmot, came from Henley with J.E. Farrar, barrister, and his wife, E.W.'s sister. Alter S. drops all his G's at the end of his words, and succeeds at first in making you think he's second class. Farrar has a completely different set of mannerisms to indicate the complete gentleman. The old lady is full of sweetness and said they would stay here in the winter. The lovable Sir Sainthill is the great authority on elephant shooting. I told him of my late friend John Marshall's unwritten book, Our Dumb Friends, How to Kill, Skin and Stuff Them. Mrs. Haynes. Colonel Freyberg, V.C., Biss, when he comes to lunch, is disappointing. For instead of talking about Gallipoli and Channel swims, he gives me long lists of the vintages of Burgundy and Port that he has. Lady Jekyll, his mother-in-law, brought a pretty little trio to lunch. Miss Asquith, Raymond A.'s daughter, Miss Mark Hamburg, a wonderful sight, and Colonel Freyberg's little stepson. I owe more to Lady Jekyll's kitchen essays than anything else, although much to Mrs. E.S.P. Haynes, who has given me some fine things. One, a jelly, which I call Huxley, thinking that it came from that part of her antecedents. She heard of it and wrote, I protest, my dear sir, that I must write to you, having in a letter from my eldest daughter now in residence at Oxford, and I trust pursuing her studies there, heard of the pleasure that she took on a visit to the Spread Eagle upon Sunday last. But first, upon one matter that she writes, I vow I will take you to task. To be short, it is the christening of very fine orange jelly by the name of Huxley. No Huxley ever had enough invention to make a jelly. If he had tried it, it would have consisted of the bones of monsters long vanished from our earth, strengthened by their eggs found in the Chinese desert. No, the jelly was made by my great-grandmother Waller, of ever-honoured memory. It has ever been a matter of gratitude in me to divine providence that in this respect I took after my father's family in their gusto for life, and I have ever endeavoured to follow in the family notion of high living and plain thinking, it being surely ordered by providence that we should not think, as is plainly shown by the numerous unhappy results of this practice. Contrariwise, the creation of animals and the fruits of the earth for the benefit of man make it an act of impiety not to use them to the greatest advantage. As says one author, a prime favourite of mine, it were a great pity that one or two peevish cynics should put good eating out of fashion. I had meant to write to you sooner upon other matters, so important that though doubtless you are already acquainted with them, I will venture upon repeating them in case they have escaped your usual penetration. These are that a bisque is a soup with a ragout in it, and that morels are not a plant, but rather an excrement of the earth that grows in woods, engendered of certain putrid moistures, but of a hot as well as of a humid quality. Command me, sir, I beg, if I can be of any assistance in sending you recipes for puptons, whether for flesh or meagre days, or a dish of pleasant pears, or even a pig soused whole after ye Spanish fashion, and how to make a sausage royal. Present, I beg, my respectful compliments to your lady, and my best wishes for the health of your infants and yourselves. Your obedient, humble servant, Oriana Haynes. Mrs. Gordon Stables, to whom I wrote saying how we had liked them when staying here, replied that that was a most gratifying testimonial to have. She may have been joking, but if not, it is rather disconcerting to think that by holding out for decent people, we are now in a position to give diplomas to people for being good hotel guests. Yet if certain hotels are listed, why shouldn't also people be listed, appointed and starred? Dormer Dillon brought to lunch Hume, an habitué of years ago when at Oxford. An odd couple, and perhaps still odder Seymour Lucas, whose perfect-looking wife persists in looking too perfect to look the part. Also at lunch were Guy Chapman and Storm Jameson, whose cheer and affection have not ceased for years. Some time ago, a colonel came to dinner with two very beautiful girls. Some suspected them, others were certain, but I maintained that they were all right, though I couldn't place them, and gave them the most expensive champagne. A fortnight later, he did the same thing with two other most beautiful girls, and the same champagne. A week or two later, an officer identified him for me as a fatherly and generous man, who took out to dinner annually the infirmary nurses. The prettiest he takes alone, the next produced in couples, and the rest in a shanabang. So I hoped to be able at least to quote him a price for a high tea for 35. But within an hour of his officer's departure, I got a telephone from the colonel booking a table with the same champagne for two. They came, and what a wonder it was. At least, for the good of the story, this ought to have happened, but didn't. And now, 5 years later, I'm still waiting for his return, in any form. Truly a beastly thing, publicity. Guy Chapman for Knopf writes for my biographical details for the jacket of what is only a simple, practical piece of tabulating utility, the Gardener's Colour Book. And Crusade Silks Limited write very politely, asking if they may make use of a letter I wrote to them asking them for some odd patterns, as being inspiring for my garden designing and others. I go through it grimly, for business sake.
Thank you very much, Malcolm, as ever, and you can hear another instalment next week. Well, Jeff Sparks is here to bring us what's going on in Bristol. Tell us, Jeff.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 11th of September, and Queen Tribute, They Will Rock You, will be performing with support from Pure at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. Also on the 11th of September, First Degree Burns will be performing at the Golden Lion in Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and our feature, The Humble Bums. This group formed in the mid-1960s in Scotland and split up in the early 1970s after releasing two albums. It is also worth mentioning that this group featured Billy Connolly, Tam Harvey and Jerry Rafferty. This song is from the album The Best of British Folk and is titled Shoeshine Boy.
Shoeshine Boy, he's making his money working downtown on Main Street. Shoeshine Boy, I know it ain't funny cleaning everything on 2 feet. Get down, get down upon your knees and brush your blues away. It won't be long till Saturday night and you'll be dancing with your lady till the break of day. Curbside bootblack. Shoeshine boy, your daddy's getting older, got to take the weight off his back. Get down upon your knees and brush your blues away. It won't be long till Saturday night and you'll be dancing with your lady till the break of day. Dancing together.
That was the Humble Bums with Shoeshine Boy from the album The Best of British Folk. Moving on to Saturday 12th of September, and Vic Goddard and the Subway Sect will be performing with support from the Stingrays and also the Pigs at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. Also on 12th of September, Electric Wizard will be performing with support from Blood Ceremony at the Trinity Centre in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. On to Sunday, 13th of September, Heaven's Basement will be performing with support from Tequila Rocking Bird and also Blue Moth at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Finally, on 13th of September, Rick Payne and the Blues Cowboys will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Bristol. The gig starts around 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you kindly, Jeff. And off he goes. And his T-shirt proclaims, "We have returned from the ashes." What that means, I don't know. But if you see him around town, then ask him. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Studio guest was Colin Powers. Thank you very much to him. Malcolm Grieve read another chapter, beautifully obviously, of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. And the features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Jess Barks brought us What's Going On in Bristol, and the studio engineer was Mark Condon, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from all of us and me, John Peters Coleman. Take care of yourselves, and I don't know if it's still technically summer, but let's try and enjoy the rest of it anyway. Bye.